And with that, we'll start off. We'll pass it over to Bjorn for a quick introduction.
Yeah, this is a mini introduction, really. Welcome to the third CMIPP Prediction Challenge debrief. We're super happy with how this went, how much participation we've gotten. It was amazing to see how things have been progressing since the first time we started this, and it's run much smoother, obviously, also after we've ironed out some of the kinks. So it's exciting to see that most of the well, I think we lost one of the winner teams at the end towards like some exams that are unfortunately running in parallel to this. Most of you guys are here. And so I think I'll hand it over to Pramod now, who actually did most of the work. So thanks to Pramod and the team and Mari and the team. I've pretty much just sat in the background. So Pramod, take it from here, please.
Okay, yeah, thanks, John, for kind introduction. So third CMIPP challenge, excuse me. So third CMIPP challenge actually started in August 2024. So this is when the actual challenge starts. The preparation of this challenge started way back, 1 year back, when we actually ran the experiments and generated data, then the curated data. So all those steps happened before announcing this challenge. And after announcing the challenge, we had 3 office hours and 3 informational sessions where we had a lot of exchange between the organizers, us, and the all the participants here, where we exchange different aspects of the challenge, starting from the task, how the data is represented, and how is the data analyzed in the past challenges. So all nice discussions we had. And we learned a lot of things through all these different exchanges between the participants and the organizers, us. And on November 22nd, which was the final submission due date, where it was nice that you all have submitted your final submissions. And in the December 2nd week, actually we announced winners, and we also released the test data. We launched the test data for this challenge, and today on March 14, we are having the debrief session to learn about the winning models, and also how this challenge for have received all the participation. So we have this pack agenda, as Mari mentioned. So we start with the introduction and the acknowledgements by the CMIPP team. Then we will have learnings from the CMIPP consortium's lab, A lab at Lahore Institute, and Kleinstein's lab at Yale Institute, where we will talk about the different models generated in this challenge, and also learning from the past 2 challenges. And after that, we will have the winning team's presentation. And towards the end, we will wrap up with the questions and the future plannings about the CMIPP challenge. Before moving to the actual debrief session, we would like to acknowledge the CMIPP team, starting with Kleinstein's lab at Yale, who are having the expertise in the big data analysis, and specifically in the domain of immunology, where Steve Ling, Jeremy, and everyone contributed from different backgrounds of systems immunology. Then Grant Lab at UCSD, who have developed the teaching materials for the CMIPP, which is recently published in Coursers as a manuscript. Then A Lab at LJI, where Joaquin, JJ, and Farhad, who have developed the high dimension reduction models for the CMIPP challenge. And lastly, our lab, Peter's lab, where starting from the experiments, Lisa and her team, then Farhan, and also the CMIPP challenge management team, which is of course Mari and Shelby, and all of us who is working in the background for from the database development. Until and from the data point of view. So throughout this journey of 3 challenges, we have We have a total 109 submission or models, and a lot of these models have been learned from the past challenges, like the best models developed in the first challenge, which were retested in the second challenge and also in the third challenge by different group of participants. And we had a lot of learnings from all these challenges. And towards end for the third challenge, we had one of the largest data set, which went public for the system technology. Like for training data set, we had almost 117 study subjects with the longitudinal immunoprofiling data sets. And for challenge data sets, which was like 54, total around 170 participants' data was released for CMVB third challenge. Just a broad overview of the third challenge. So we released the immunoprofiling data sets, which is multiomics in nature. In total, we had 171 enrolled study participants for which this data was, the blood sample was collected and experiments were run. We had six tasks in two tasks in pair. We asked to predict monocytes on day one, like absolute values, and we had fold change based prediction. And this went in pair for monocytes. Similarly, for CCL3, we asked to predict absolute values on day three and also baseline to day three fold changes. And also, we had tasks related to IgG. Produces toxin on day 14 prediction, absolute values and the fold change values, base ranks. And then we develop a scoring where in the first step, we calculate the Spearman correlation. And based on this Spearman correlation, we develop the point system, which is spelled like this to have identified the winners for the challenge. We also had the some cash prizes and also a lot of these nice data sets and the way the data was processed. So all these resources were made available in public domain, like GitHub, Zenodo, etc., and also the sequencing databases like NCBI. And all these data sets are made available through our CMIPP website. So total, we received all 56 models with the in-detail summaries, where we asked contestants to fill in different questions about their models, and thank you all for writing those details for us. And most participants made available their models on GitHub. And if you haven't done so far, we ask you to please do that. So these details are very essential when we write the paper. So taking this write up, we develop a systematic data collection plan in tabular format. And using that, we are generating the manuscript figures, tables, and the discussions. So submissions versus the prediction tasks. So these are the number of significant Spearman correlation coefficients by the number of models submitted. So like for 1.1 task, where we ask for IgGPT, day 14, titer absolute base rank predictions, where we had 26 models who had significant Spearman correlation out of 56, and likewise for the other tasks. So you can see here the 2.1, 1.1, and 3.1, where we say these are the easy tasks, where we had the maximum number of Spearman correlation coefficient significant identified. Then we had the moderate and the difficult. To predict. We also learned a lot of about the data processing, how it is done by the contestants and how it is done by the winning teams. So we provided the data processing approach, which we learned from the past three challenges. And we are happy to see that a lot of different participants have used this data processing approach, not directly, but also the code to rerun those pipelines for their own purposes. After this, we have a consortium lab presentation, starting with ALAP, where JJ will first present ALAP's module. JJ, over to you.
Yeah, thanks, Pramod. May I share my screen?
Yes.
Sure.
Thank you. Okay. Can you see my slides?
Yes.
Okay. Let me just put it on slideshow. All right, great. So my name is Jamil Jan. I go by JJ since it's easier to go that way because C's are like J's in Turkish. I'm a third year BISB PhD student at UCSD at the Ferhat Eyes Lab. And today I will be summarizing the work I have done for the CMIPB challenge using Jive for joint dimensionality reduction and tasks prediction in the CMIPB challenges. Before I get started with the talk, I just want to say a quick few words about the challenge and everything around it. So this was actually my first time joining the challenge out of the three challenges, and it was actually quite interesting for me in terms of learning experience, especially dealing with a multi-omic data set that I didn't have prior experiences with. And my current research is around multi-omic data in some sort. So it was definitely a great experience and learning moment for me. So I would like to thank the CMIPB team, especially Pramod for his help, and Marie for organizing all sorts of things. And also I would like to thank my PI, Dr. I, for giving me this opportunity to participate and expand my knowledge in this regard. So with that quick introduction, I do want to repeat a slide that Pramod just mentioned. So this was the third challenge, the open challenge with 117 training samples or subjects and 54 subjects for the test data that were kind of accumulated throughout the years for this challenge. So just to sort of reiterate what the task categories were and what the tasks were. So we had four, let's say, main challenges with three different task categories and the bonus challenge. Just a quick disclaimer, I did not attempt the bonus task, so I will mostly be focusing on the top three tasks. So the first challenge was the antibody titer tasks. Second one was the cell frequency task, and the third one was the gene expression task. And each task category had two different tasks for each one of them. So the antibody titer tasks had the ranking of individuals by IgG antibody titers against pertussis toxin 14 days post booster. And the task number two was the rank individuals by the fold change of IgG titers. For the cell frequency task, we had the rank individuals by predicted frequency of monocytes on day one post booster, and then ranking individuals by the fold change in monocyte frequency. That was the task number two. And for the gene expression tasks, we had the rank individuals by predicted gene expression of CCL3 on day three post booster, and then rank individuals by the fold change in CCL3 expression. So what kind of a data that we're dealing with? That was the most important question I wanted to ask myself. And then when we look at the data types, we see PBMC cell frequencies, antibody titers, plasma proteomics, PBMC transcriptomics, and antigen-specific T cell responses. So we clearly have a multimodal or multi-omic data set, which sort of motivated us towards finding a approach that can deal with multi-omics data and do further analysis on it. So we went to one of the old papers, the Cantini et al. Paper, that summarized a lot of dimensionality reduction methods, joint dimensionality reductions on multi-omics data. They summarized eight different approaches on different types of data sets, as shown in panel B. And we mostly wanted to focus on how the approaches did in the cancer data set, because This type of data set was much more similar to the one that we are dealing with for the CMIPB challenge. So we went down that route and then looked at how each individual method
agency,
was,
which is how you actually become an expert your other.
So we looked into how each individual method performed for different types of cancer data sets. And we can see that out of the results, Jive is one of the good performing ones amongst all these other methods. So, and Jive was also used previously in the first two challenges by the previous member, Joaquin, who represented the iLab. So I just basically followed his footsteps along that path. So once we decided that we're going to be using Jive, we had to sort of come up with a pipeline or approach on how to handle this multi-omics data. So we essentially took the harmonized data that was provided by the CMIPB team on the website. And then after some data cleaning and aggregation, because Jive requires a certain style of input, we ran the Jive decomposition on the harmonized data. And then after we got some outputs, which I'll be talking more about shortly, we did training and evaluation of the predictive models. And then we did some performance visualization and analysis, and then later on submitted the results. So this is a typical workflow for a lot of methods. So going a little bit more into the depths or details of how we did the Jive decomposition, as I mentioned, we took the harmonized data for training purposes only, of course, not on the test data. And then the most important part that goes into these types of multimodal, multi-omic methods is that we took the intersection of samples across all assays. And this is kind of a crucial step because essentially the number of rows or the number of subjects, let's say, need to match throughout different assays in order for the method to actually work. So that did drop the number of subjects that we can actually use for the training data, since not every subject was present for every single assay. So we had to do a lot of cutting out in terms of subjects there. And then when it comes to Jive, it separates the data into joint factors, or you can almost think as different principal components if you were to think about PCs or factors in this case. And it also checks the specific individual assay specific components as well. And then the outputs are essentially the factors for each sample and loadings for each assay. So basically how the Jive decomposition looks like this. We have different multimodal data with a different number of columns. Essentially, you can see every rectangle being different in columns, but hopefully it's intuitive that the number of rows in this case are same. And then that goes straight into Jive. And then we chose to use loading factor of matrices of K equals 10. Surely can be used a lot more. It really depends. I think when I did the elbow curve, 10 was sufficing in terms of analysis of this data. So, and here is how it sort of looks. Once we get the factors out of these models, we concatenate those factors and then train five different models using the factor matrices, using the following equation here, where y is the outcome response variable, x is the input predictor of the data, m is a matrix coefficient that maps x to y, beta is the intercept or the bias term, and epsilon is the arid term, which captures noise or unexplained variation. So out of all of these results, the Lasso results came out to be the best. Although we tried linear regression, Lasso, ElasticNet, Lasso with CV, and ElasticNet with CV, but Lasso came out to be the best one. So I'm just going to present those results very quickly here. So here you can see the Spearman correlation for the five tasks here I'm showing, but clearly you can see the monocytes, if you can see my cursor, monocytes day one, and in terms of absolute value, monocytes day one fold change are the best performing ones out there compared to the other three results. And when we look at the factors or features that contributed into the decision of the monocytes day one, we see that the PBMC cell frequency is quite dominant in the top four factors, and even at the bottom we see the PBMC cell frequency once again, but we can see a dominance of one of the factors there. And if we look at the correlation here, the true outcome versus the predicted outcome, we can actually see a quite good Spearman correlation and then a relatively low p-value. And there are a couple of outliers here and there, but overall, we see a pretty good line that fits into this this plot. Similarly, if we were to look at the top 10 features for the monocytes day one fold change, we see a little bit of a change. We see PBMC gene expression, one of the top factor, but we also see that the plasma cytokine has two factors, and then gene expression again, and then and yeah, it so on goes in that order. So this one's a little bit more of a let's say, should have been easier, but for some reason it wasn't as easy as the other one. But yeah, still we see some good results here. And if you look at, once again, the correlation, apart from these, let's say, two outliers that are on the right side of the plot, we see that the line is fitting pretty nicely into this as well. So that's all the results I have. These were the ones that performed relatively well compared to the other results. So I just wanted to highlight the most important ones. And yeah, just once again, would like to thank everyone, Pramod, Marie, CMIPB team, and my PI, Dr. I. And thank you all for listening and joining. And yeah, that's all I have. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, JJ. We're a little bit over already, so we're going to skip the questions for now and then pass it over to the clients. So thank you, JJ.
Thank you.
John, if you're ready, if you can start screen sharing, that'll be awesome.
Yep. Okay, it's everything looks good on your side?
Yes.
Okay, good. Okay. Hi everyone. My name is Jianxing, and I'm the postdoc associate from Dr. Steven Kleistin Lab at Yale University. I'm happy to be here with my colleague Burhan to share our models and the findings from the third MAPB prediction challenge. So all these works are under the guidance of our advisor, Dr. Lin Guan. Okay. And throughout our history in the CMIPB challenge, the Yale team has consistently submitted the predictive models like from the past the challenge. And previously, the ANA led the development of the MCIA prediction model, And Jeremy performed the prediction using the SPEAR model. And this year, we have continued to evolve our approaches. And so briefly, I used the easy, like the lasso regression model. And Burhan has extended our prediction by implementing the SPEAR model for the new like the 2023 data set. And in our analysis, we used the pre-processed data that provided by the CMIPP team, which had already undergone the batch effect correction to ensure the consistency across different data sets from different year and across all the assay. And our primary goal was to use the predictive model to, of course, help better understand of the vaccine-induced immunity to the B pertussis. And also, because we are performing like the different models, we want to also compare the different models that performed by our team and to identify the most effective approaches to predict the immune responses for the different tasks. Okay, so I would introduce the model that I performed, which is a lasso regression prediction model. And here it's very straightforward. We used like the training data for the past 3 years, 2020, 21, 22, and we create different models like divided by the their vaccination type, either the whole cell vaccination or a cellular vaccines. And then we used like the lasso 5-word cross validation model and divided them into like 80%, 20% to pretty straightforward to find the best the best model, the linear models to the predict the test the to test data. And we also use those training data to create some evaluation, like randomly choose the data from the training data to perform some evaluation model to make sure, yes, it's good to go. And then we introduce the challenge data, which is a new data from 2023, to predict the and rank the subject by the prediction results. So the performance of the lasso regression prediction models, we can see a good prediction for task one. Actually, this is task 1.1 and task 2.1, which is we are the linear data is good for not the full change but the titer or any other values directly, and I think so those are the evaluation models, and we can see a good like the evaluation like correlations between the predicted values and the actual values that we used in the evaluation models. For the task 3.1, the evaluation looks good, but I also include the lasso regression cross validation performance in here. Because we would want to, I would want to point out that probably there's some like the potential discrepancy when leaving out one random samples, we think it's because maybe some important features may get dropped in different random runs. So overall, even the evaluation model looks good. When we introduce some new, we introduce like the new data from 2023, it doesn't really look that good. We think probably it's because of this reason. That's why I would want to include and point out in here. And I think I would pass over to Burhan to introduce his work.
Okay, yeah, thanks, Jian. So I use Pure model. It was developed by Jeremy, one of the previous grad students in the lab. He develops Pure, a signature-based multiple omics integration via latent factor. So it uses data from multiple omics or different modalities, integrates them together using this adaptive framework where it tries to preserve the variance with X and also tries to explain the response variable. So it try and together it then comes up with the factor the factor loadings, which can be used for predictions further. Next slide, please. Thank you. Yeah. We use the harmonized data that Pramod had already uploaded on the website, and that had a bunch of missing subjects for different assays. So we perform MoFA imputation to complete the data set. So that way we could use all 117 subjects that were there in the data set. We use that data set for training the Spear model. We extracted the factor loadings and then added the baseline values, clinical data that includes age, sex, vaccine priming status, etc., and then performed lasso to get the target variable. For the prediction task, we use the trained Spear model from the previous step and the lasso step. But the Spear model was the same for all the different tasks, only the lasso model was changing for each different tasks. Okay, and next slide. And I'll show you some of the results from our internal cross-validation, which we did when we trained the data on 2020 and 2021 and cross-validated in 2022 data. So one thing we observed was for predicting the absolute values, that was task 1.1, 2.1, 3.1, we saw good correlation between the true value and the predicted value, probably because the baseline is a really good predictor of the values. But when we looked at the fold change, they were much tougher. So here I'm showing results for task one, so antibody titer prediction, and the with the absolute values, which is so the first row, first column, you can see the results sort of correlate well. But when we look at the fold change, it is not as good. And with monocyte prediction, the absolute values were really good. But with the fold change, the model just returned the mean value, basically. And that wasn't really helpful. For the third task, we also didn't see much. We had some issues with the prediction, so I didn't end up submitting. But yeah, so it was quite interesting that the absolute values were easier, but fold change was tougher. And that's it. Thank you. And we are happy to take any questions.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you. We're right on time, so maybe we could just move on for now. Next, we have the winner of the bonus task, Anya, if you're ready to just begin screen sharing.
Sure.
And awesome.
I think this might be better. Okay. Let me share my screen. Give me one sec. Sorry. Can you guys see it?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So yeah, my name is Anya, and I'm going to be talking about my model for the bonus task, which was the TH1, TH2 polarization ratio, and I used MoFA, so multiomics factor analysis. So here's just an overview of my methodology. I started with data preprocessing, then I did feature selection with MoFA, and then my final prediction model was Lasso. So for the pre-processing, I took all of the batch-corrected data at time point zero, and then all of the assays and all of the years, and then MoFA, for MoFA to represent the group, I took the outcome as group, and so that required discrete values, and so for that, I binned it into 8 equal range bins. And so the second part of the methodology was MoFA, which was my feature selection. And so just like a little overview of how MoFA works, it essentially performs a PCA-like dimensionality reduction, and it tries to capture the maximum variance in the data through latent factors. And so each factor is essentially a weighted combination of all features, and it forms a sort of line against the multidimensional data. And these weights are found using variational Bayesian inference. So the weights for each line are chosen to maximize the probability of seeing the observed data given those weights. And so MoFA doesn't need missing values to be imputed, and it simply learns patterns from the data that it does have. And it uses ARD, or automatic relevance determination, to find the sparse weights and factors, and it ends up dropping any unnecessary factors. It also ensures that the factors have sparse weights and they're not dependent on too many features. And so overall, MoFA's factors capture both assay-specific and multiomics variance. And so what I did is to extract the top features by analyzing the most correlated factors to the multiomics trends. So the reason I chose MoFA was because with large data sets like the one for this challenge, there's a few issues that can come up, like missing values, high dimensional data, and lots of interconnectivity between the features. And so MoFA provides a solution to these problems by using unsupervised learning, where it can deal very effectively with missing values. And then its dimensionality reduction approach makes it very useful for highly dimensional data. So for the predictive model, I used Lasso, which is just a linear regression model. And I used just the data from the top features that I found. And I had an elastic net penalty to find sparse but adequate amounts of features. And once we found the top features, I used grid search with five-fold cross-validation to find the best parameters for the model. So the reason I chose Lasso, which is like linear regression, over some other predictive models, is because I think it's less sensitive to hyperparameter changes, and it has a very simple structure, so it makes it easy to interpret, and it doesn't suffer from the black box problem, which is where it's hard to see how the model is making its decisions. And it also promotes sparsity in its weights by reducing coefficients to zero. And by balancing L1 and L2 regularization, it's able to find sparse features without becoming too dependent on too few a number of features. So for MoFA, I decided to make the algorithm take only one factor, and so that factor would then explain the most variance. And then I took the top features from each assay in that factor. And the reason I took it from each assay was I noticed when I was just taking the top features overall, they tended to be biased towards the gene expression assay. They were just all from the gene expression assay, I think due to the large number of features that it had. And so I used the top features, which you can see here. I put some of them on the slide. And for my final predictive model, there was elastic net, and I ended up getting a correlation of 0.371 on the 2023 data set. So yeah, that's all I had. I would love to answer any questions.
Thank you, Anya. Does anyone have any particular questions for Anya's presentation?
So this is Björn, a quick question and maybe a little overreaching, but do you have a biological interpretation? of what worked in the prediction.
I noticed that some of these markers that I found were like the antibody levels against the some of the proteins and like pertussis toxin, which is related to the bacteria. So I think that was kind of what kind of gave me the confidence that these results, these markers actually make sense and they're not just randomly chosen.
Thank you.
Any other questions before we move on to the next presentation? Okay, awesome. Thank you, Anya.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Great. Next, we have Philip, who will be presenting on the second place model.
Yes, let me just share my screen real quick. So you can see my screen?
Yes.
I guess. Okay, perfect. Yeah, so I guess just very briefly, I'm a second year PhD student in Heidelberg, so it's also evening here. I'm with Julio Saas Rodriguez, who is now also head of research at Amble EBI. And I just want to start the presentation by thanking everyone who was involved in the organization of the challenge. I think it was very well organized. And yeah, I think you did a very, very good job. And now I want to start by talking about some of the key challenges and key priorities that I kind of saw in this. I mean, obviously, we've also kind of seen that before. There's like lots of features and very few subjects. And then there's kind of like different groups of prediction tasks. We have different data modalities going into the prediction, and there were some batch effects. And kind of like based on these, say, like key challenges or key observations, I thought there's kind of like two priorities. First of all, I wanted to have kind of like what I call like a solid quality control and data pre-processing of the experimental data. Also because I guess I was not really familiar with most of the assays, only with, of course, bulk RNA-seq I use quite a bit, but I mostly work with single cell and spatial data. So I had no clue about these T cell activation assays or the Olink or Legend Plex data. And so I wanted to do the pre-processing myself, just to have a look at the data. And then I wanted to have a solid model evaluation work, which I will talk about in a second. And then also what I found interesting is again that it was so difficult to beat the baselines, which I think we could also discuss at the end of this meeting. And yeah, I also saw that I cannot sort things in the correct order. And yeah, and one other thing which I didn't know how to deal best with is kind of like that many of these assays are missing for the 2020 cohort. So I actually ended up not using it for most tasks, which leaves you with very few subjects. Yeah, and I think, I mean, this is just for reference, because also it was quite some time ago, but so I did quite a, let's call it a strict quality control. I removed basically stuff where there were like different units or if it was below the limit of quantification or detection. Yeah, this is just, I mean, this follows very similar to the notebook that was provided, to be honest, what kind of normalization I use and also the integration stuff. And now let's get to the more interesting stuff, I think. So basically, because I knew that it's so easy to overfit, and also what I did before, I just did random cross-validation, so just disregarding the cohorts. And then I had like a super good performance, and I knew from the previous challenges that probably this doesn't make sense. And so I decided to use kind of like a stratified k-fold validation, where first split by the cohort, and then within the training sets, I just did here like leave one out cross-validation for hyperparameter optimization, which, similarly to what was presented before for GLMNet, for example, for the regularization parameters, because I used three different kinds of models. So basically Lasso, where we only have the L1 penalty, ElasticNet, where I basically had 0.5 L1 and 0.5 L2 penalty, and then Random Forest, because I thought it's quite robust. And I choose all of them because I thought they would be robust in the large P, small N setting. And then as input, I just used the power set of all assays. So basically I tested only using, PBMC gene expression, only using PBMC cell frequency, or using PBM cell frequency and PBMC gene expression. So this was quite exhaustive. So you basically have like a long loop. So you basically like you have a loop over each task for each model, and then for each data subset. And then I hope this is not way too tiny. So I basically ended up having like such tables. So say, for example, these are all the results that I had for task 2.1. Then like for the different models here, like Random Forest, ElasticNet, or Lasso. And then these are here like the results for the 2021 data, for the 2022 data. And then here on the right side is the feature set. And basically, so here, because we used LegendPlex data in this iteration, I just excluded the 2020 data set. And then basically, based on these tables for each task, I chose a combination of model and feature set. So to like choose the final model and data, I, of course, looked at the top ranking performance. And I also wanted to have a low variance between the test sets. So I basically wanted to have here the variance between the holdout prediction or the performance. So this is the Spearman correlation for the 2021 data and for the 2022 data. I wanted always this to be kind of low. Like if several models had like a really good performance, I choose the ones that were more regularized. And I also chose models that didn't use Olink or any kind of data that was often missing in the test data. Like if we go back to this thing, so I noticed that in the test data, the 2023 data, that Olink is missing quite often. So I thought probably makes sense to not use models that use it. Some other notes. I mean, I also thought about testing MoFA, MoFA Plus, but I didn't really have the time. I tested one feature selection algorithm. Maybe some of you are familiar with that. It's the Spirota algorithm. But it was computationally quite expensive and the performance was not really convincing. And I think for the discussion in the end, I think it would be interesting to discuss why the baseline, or why it's so difficult to beat the baseline. And also how to best incorporate the minus 14 or minus 30 days data that is available for the more recent cohorts, because I didn't use it at all. And with that, I'm done. I'm happy to take any questions.
No. Thank you, Philip. If you have any questions, if you can unmute yourself or raise your hand, that'll be fantastic.
Just a quick question. Did you get any sense of which data contributed the most to, you know, predictions, etc.? So there's all these data sets, but, you know, can you say that all of them contributed, or there was some one of them that is, you feel like, or at least for particular prediction tasks, that were better than others? Do we need all the data, essentially?
That's my biggest question.
I think the challenge is great. Do we really need that data?
I mean, I would assume not, to be honest, but I haven't checked explicitly. I need to check how often I'm using a certain data set, and then also write like how many features from a given data set. Like maybe you don't have to test as many antibodies or whatnot. But yeah, this is something I should check actually. That'd be interesting.
So I had actually a question along the exact same lines. I mean, I think you're a strict QC where you're eliminating everything where, say, I mean, just as a bit of background, I'm not sure if that came across, but like the reason why we switch when we have suddenly different units is because suddenly an assay was no longer available. and we couldn't run the same assay again. And you would think that whatever measuring a protein concentration or so would be comparable between assays, but essentially you're saying by throwing everything out that is not exact, you're not losing anything because you performed really well. And I
But
think
I
this
like
speaks
to be
towards
honest, I
the,
didn't, sorry.
yeah, go ahead.
I mean, I just wanted to say I didn't do the test, like what really contributed to the performance. Like if I were to like plug
Well,
in
there's the
the
indirect test.
harmonic.
You performed really well and you did this. And I know lots of other people tried, and including us, and I
Be
think also what
careful
Vitaly was
correlation
saying.
and causation. As a scientist, let's not correlate and
Yeah,
cause.
we should look into it. But I mean, this is okay, sorry, this is very much also matches our own, I mean, lessons learned after a number of years. I mean, is it, I think we have the data to say it's better to have a few measures that you consistently can reproduce over many years, rather than having a lot more. I think Vitaly, that's what you were getting at also, what does it actually help you of having like partial other data sets? How much do you actually gain? And this is an important thing, right? Lots of people who do these multi-omic studies and saying, let's add this, let's add that. I think there's really there needs to be a demonstration how much that really adds.
No, I mean, I totally agree with that.
I mean, biologically, it sucks, right? You want to, it must add something. It should add something, or our model should ignore it, but it doesn't. Ultimately, we add another random variable that will confuse a model if because we don't have large enough data sets. So, but I mean, just like conceptually, if we had all the data in the world, it should be just fine to add another measurement.
No, there is a
I
law
guess.
of diminishing returns, actually. That statement is wrong, what you just said.
Diminishing returns, yes, but a good algorithm. I've worked on many of these.
No, yeah, it's all BS. Nah.
Well, we can, I think, move on from there.
But I guess like one related thing is also what a lot of people work on, like on the machine learning side of things, to predict some modalities from other modalities, right? And if this works, like it's kind of the question also how many degrees of freedom there are in biology. But like in my field, for example, like if I can take single cell RNA-seq data and can perfectly predict like using a super large model that has seen a lot of data, I can perfectly predict, I don't know, like ataxic profiles or stuff like that, right? This essentially tells you that it's kind of redundant information. But yeah. Okay.
Perfect. And this would be, I mean, also the reason why I'm harping on these things. We are obviously trying to write this up. And I think these are important points. And we would love to get those opinions and insights there and well, because we do want to learn from this whole thing.
Thank you. Any other questions for Philip?
I have a question about your models, because I'm curious about, like, you used a lot of like the models to predict the prediction to really compare and find, like, just to use the best one for the final prediction, right? Maybe I missed this, but do you have any, so for each of the tasks, what is, I'm just curious, what is, are they like you use different models to predict for each of the tasks, or is there any
Yes, I mean, like actually
one?
was quite diverse, to be honest. I mean, maybe I have this. I should have put this
Yeah,
in
I'm
the
just
slides,
curious
but
about the diversity of how well, like, for each of the models to predict based on each of the tasks.
do I have this here? I would need to one second. I don't know how fast I can find this out, but I can also get back to you. But it was different models basically. So I did not always use kind of like Lasso or ElasticNet or Random Forest. So let's see. Where did I write this? Yeah, otherwise I can show you later. I'm looking at my code, so
It's fine. It's just just curious about like if it's for different tasks like oh well on each of this
But
the
it was
models.
different models and different datas, like data
Okay.
modalities.
Yeah.
That's
Yes.
what
Yes.
I know
Yes.
for sure.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, maybe you can retell later. Thank you.
Thank you both. Thank you for the presentation. Awesome. Next, we have Cheng Cheng.
Hi.
Hi. Would you
My I share a screen.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry. Yeah.
We're seeing a dog so far, which is
Yeah, sorry
impressive.
about that. Yeah, can you see my screen?
Yes, you see your slides now.
Yeah, okay, sorry about that. hi everyone, I'm Ning Shen Chen and my teammate is Chen Chang Wu. We are both graduate students. We are excited to share our modeling approach with you today. I was going to cover the objectives, but since they were already mentioned at the beginning of the meeting, so I'll go ahead and skip this slide. Here's an overview of our process, which we'll break down in the following slide. First, we'll discuss how we process the raw data and handle missing values through imputation. Next, we'll go over the modeling method we considered. So we consider random forest and gain loss loss here. And finally, we'll explain how we evaluated model performance and selected our final models here. Okay, so from the raw data, we extracted antibody titers and cytokines level, cell frequencies, and gene expression at 6 time points listed here, day 0, 1, 3, 7, 14, 30 for the training set, with only day 0 data available for testing. And since the data had different features across years, we kept only the ones that were consistently available every year. And also, before analysis, we normalized and standardized the data. First, we apply a log 1 plus x transformation. Then we standardize the values to have a mean of 0 and a standard deviation of 1. For each data modality across years, we filter features based on two criteria listed here. First, we remove features with more than 50% missing values. And second, we exclude the features where over 80% of the observation were identical because these values seem unreliable, as well as to ensure enough variability in the data. Our initial PCA analysis revealed batch effects across years. To handle this, we use the comeback method from the SVA package, adjusting for factors like vaccine type and biological sex. And to handle missing values in the multi-omics, we first combine all four data modalities and time points into a tensor. This creates a three-dimensional structure with time points, futures, and subjects. As shown here, you can see this plot. And each slice is a heat map from a specific time point. Each column is a subject, and rows are futures. Each dot or cell in the heat map represents the value or expression from one particular features of a sample. And you can see the blue colors here. Blue corresponds to features that are underexpressed, meaning they have smaller values. And there's also a red color here. Red indicates features that are highly expressed, and black indicates missing values. So you can see here all the testing data after baseline are missing. Imputation was then performed using a tensor decomposition-based approach through the TensorMiss package. This method considers three-way correlation across subject, features, and time series to impute missing values. And by using the entire data set together, we hope this will provide us with more reliable imputation. After imputation, we apply PCA to the imputed baseline data for dimension reduction. We kept the first 20 principal components as the explained variance beyond this point increase only slightly with each additional PC. And this might suggest that additional PCs capture more noise than meaningful patterns. Now I'm going to talk about the modeling approach. Two predictive modeling of methods will consider random forest and gain loss loss, which stands for generalized addictive model with L1 penalized linear terms. Although we imputed the entire dataset, both models were trained only using data from subject with observed outcome. This means that subject with imputed outcomes were excluded from the model building process. The candidate predictors include vaccine type, biological sex, and age. Additionally, we include 20 principal components and baseline values of the target outcomes, such as baseline IgGPT for predicting day 14 IgGPT. The exact predictors included in each model were slightly different, and we will cover this in the next few slides, along with how we evaluated the models and selected the final one. So for the random forest was considered because it is one of the most popular and go-to method for prediction tasks given its strong performance. We included vaccine type, biological sex, and age as predictors, along with the baseline value of the target outcome to predict future outcomes. Additionally, the first 20 principal components were included, serve as eigenfeatures that capture underlying patterns and variability in the multi-omic data. And for the game lasso model, lasso is another popular go-to method for prediction tasks, but it assumes linear relationship between the predictors and the outcome. Since PCA is our previous steps, it's also a linear method. We wanted to introduce more flexibility in the predictors, hoping to better capture association with the outcome. So we found this game lasso method online and decided to use it, as it allows for nonlinear modeling through a generalized addictive approach while using L1 penalization on the linear terms. This method is basically combining lasso and game into one model. At the bottom here, we show the equation of our game lasso model. We treated vaccine type, biological sex, and baseline values as linear terms, and model age, principal components, and interaction term between the first PC and vaccine type nonlinearly. For the nonlinear terms, we use penalized cubic splines with 10 knots, which are the F function here for each term. You can see the F function here. Since the sample size is not really huge, and cubic spline estimation can quickly eat up degrees of freedom, we limited the number of PCs to between 1 to 5 for the model, and the optimal number were determined using cross-validated MSE. And to assess model performance and compare these models, we use mean square error evaluated from tenfold cross-validation. Both the original scale and phone trend tests were predicted using the same model. For the phone trend prediction, we derived it from the predicted values on the original scale and the baseline values. Here are the tenfold across validation MSE results for the both models. The table at the top shows the result from a random forest model for each outcome, while the table at the bottom here displays the result from the game lasso model with different numbers of, with the best result here. We can see the random forest outperforms game lasso in every outcome. You can see this one is 0.486, and this one is 0.511, and this one is 0.683, it's 1.012. And the last one, Rhinophores is also slightly lower than the Game Lasso. And the best one here is the PC1. And this one is PC1 to PC3. And last one is PC1. So which lead us to choose it as our final model for a prediction for the random forest. And thank you for your attention. And a big thanks to the CMIPB team for hosting this event and providing this opportunity. That's what we have today. We'll be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Nuxian.
Thank you.
If you have any questions, if you can unmute yourself or raise your hand.
I mean, I just have one short question. How did you come up with this interaction term between vaccine and PC1? Like, did you check for more interaction terms or?
Yeah, so I think we didn't check the interaction term, but I feel like vaccine type should be a very, or at least should be a, like an important predictors in this task. And we want to introduce like more flexibility as we mentioned. And since PC1 will cover like the most variants within this multi-omic data set, so we think it should be a good idea to introduce like this interaction term inside our model.
Okay, thanks a lot.
A short question. So you use the data after the vaccine challenge in the training set, and that does include, say, day 14. So mm-hmm. why wasn't the model that is just taking the values from the training and just fitting that? That model should fit perfectly. So I'm not understanding the rationale of taking the data that is after the vaccination into the training.
Oh, data. Yeah. So I think basically, since there are still missing values in the baseline, right? Like even for the training set. And we want to impute those missing values as precise as possible. So we want to like borrow the strength from the entire data set. That's mostly the reason why we're including post-baseline values inside our model. But we didn't use it directly because we only use the imputed baseline to build our model.
Okay, so it's what so I didn't understand. So, but then you don't need to use day 30. Like, if you want day zero imputed, you just need something before the vaccination, -5, and you need +2 or +3, whatever is not. Like, you don't need to use up to day 30. There was a statement here, it says day zero, yeah, so day 30. So I don't understand still rationale there.
Yeah, so I think basically since we're imputing the data using three-way correlations, so it doesn't mean like it considered both or like all the correlations in features, meaning that they capture the correlation between features and they capture also the correlation between times as well as the correlation within subjects, right? So even though you know we know the baseline, some subjects, they might be more similar to each other within their post-baseline values. So we wanna borrow this kind of information inside our imputation for the baseline.
Okay, cool.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Yeah. Sorry, I might have missed. What method do you use for calculating PCs?
You mean like extracting the PCs from?
Yeah.
A regular PCA.
Okay. So you club all the multiomics data set together and then calculate principal.
Yeah. So I think these features here contains four modalities, which are antibodies, cell frequencies, cytokine, and gene expression.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
And related to that, so it's quite striking that, you know, one PC or you had the case with one PC1 to PC3 were giving you the best results. How much variance did you capture in just that one?
Yeah, so I don't recall, but I think with 20 PC, it only includes like 44% of variance, I believe. So probably like 10 something. I don't have it with me right now, but sure. I think it's relatively low.
Relatively low. So that goes back to the previous point, you know, do we need all this data? Right.
Yeah. So I think
this is suggested we don't.
I think within our all our models, baseline was actually the most important predictors.
Yeah, that's really striking. Yeah. Thank you.
I just have one more question. Why did you choose to log normalize everything? I mean, for gene expression, I guess it makes sense that you have some kind of variant stabilizing transformation, but what about the other assays? Or like, what was your thought process there?
I think I checked their histogram and most of them are like skewed to the right. And I don't recall very correctly, but I think when we use the tensor mis imputation, like when we use our mean value imputation method, since it's like SVD or something, so probably normalize the data will work better for it. Yeah.
Okay, but did you ever test to like not log normalize everything? Just out of curiosity, did you like you did it and then you just
yeah,
ran
not
with that?
Really, because the imputation process took pretty long time. I think it took like one day to do it, so we don't have much time.
Yeah.
Okay, I see. Thank you.
I mean, that speaks to another more general point, right? So we're describing what methods work, but then, as was said before, is this a no? Which parts of the models actually contributed is not clear. Ideally, we would have another whatever year and we can go through and try all kinds of variations and see what is the actual effect of whatever, say, this normalization or the different, like I asked Philip, in terms of the different QC cleaning, doing it yes or no or something like that. It would be awesome to do this. I suspect we will not have the time, but I mean, that would be another potential thing, right? This identifies a number of factors. And one could now retrospectively go in and test the importance of each. So
I mean, maybe if LLMs get good enough and you give it to like some LLM agent and be like test like all these degrees of freedom, I don't know.
Yeah,
maybe in a couple of I don't know, not so soon.
Any other questions? Awesome. Thank you both. Thank you, Ning Chen, and thank you, Cheng Cheng.
Thank you.
And thank you for the animal pictures. It's a feature in my lab that at the end, you always end with a picture of your pet. I suspect you don't have a seal as your pet. Normally, it's cats and dogs that we're seeing. So thank you for that.
Awesome. As you all may have noticed, we did not have our third place presentation, as Bjorn had mentioned at the beginning, but they kindly recorded their presentation and sent us their GitHub. So I'll also put that in the chat as well, if you would like to take a look. And this is also available in our discussion forum on the CMIPB page. Cool. And with that, Pramada, I'll hand it back to you.
Thank you. So yeah, so you see, we have a lot of learnings until now. So we are going with the all the submitted models, not just from the third challenge, but from the previous challenges. So just to summarize the paper or manuscript journey so far for all the CMIPB challenges. So we have the first challenge results manuscript, which was published in Self-Put Methods, where we actually established the CMIPB challenge. And then we have the second challenge manuscript, which was recently accepted in PLOS Completion Biology, and now it's in the production state. We also publish CMIPB as a teaching material resource. And please feel free to take a look at our course source lesson manuscript. And right now, we are writing the third challenge manuscript with all the understanding we are generating so far. With the discussions we had so far. Next slide, please. So for this manuscript, all the contestants with at least one significant SPEM coalition coefficient with in any of these seven tasks will be.
Rama, he's starting to break up a bit. Can you speak more directly in the mic, please?
Oh, sorry. So main authors and the consortium authors will be listed. And then we have write-up and the planning for the discussions. Currently, we are taking help of all the winners' teams and the teams where we had a lot of nice understanding. We are going back and forth with them. Yeah, thank you.
So can I add a little bit to this? So the main criticism we got from reviewers for the second round of manuscripts, or not actually criticism, they liked it, but they said, like, please tell us more about the biology learned. What did you learn? So that's going to be one of the challenges. So we were very curious, also having these kinds of discussions that we had briefly on the call, to put these in the discussion of this manuscript. That would be really awesome. So it would be really cool. We need to circulate the manuscript, and we would love, and we don't have to all have the same opinion, right? We can have different views in there. So that's also fine in the discussion of the findings. I think that's one of the awesome things about this. And then the other thing is, we have started, and I don't think I was expecting, and I forgot about this, a link here for the CMI flu thing now. Do we have that? Is still a final slide?
Yes, we can go to the next slide.
Okay, so cool. Maybe then we just, sorry, I thought that. This is okay. Not CMI flu. Okay, awesome. Yes, perfect.
Yeah, so we had like three challenges so far for CMIPV, where we really tried to understand the vaccination response specific to purposes of booster vaccination. And now we are moving to understand the influenza vaccination. And for that, we are establishing CMIFlu as the next round of prediction challenges. So yeah, which are starting next year. And we would love you all have your participation and input there as well.
So this is the way I wanted to add some color. We would have loved to continue pertussis, but the NIH essentially changed it and said, okay, we have funded the previous computational models of immunity program for two cycles, and then they're kind of forced to create a new program. So the new program is very similar, but it is all going to be influenza vaccination. So this is not our choice to say, let's drop pertussis. I thought actually pertussis was awesome, because influenza vaccination, obviously a lot more people are already working on this, and pertussis was like a nice niche here. So, but that's, I guess that was my background here. We're not switching because we don't think pertussis is important anymore. This is part of the grant funding mechanism. Yeah. But then also kind of this feedback that we are potentially getting here, and in terms of like also what kind of data do we need? What kind of data is most valuable? We would really love to learn, because we can implement that now. We're going to start data generation at the end of this year, pretty much. So we obviously want to learn as much as possible from the pertussis world going forward.
Awesome. And with that, if you have any questions or comments about any of the presentations that we saw today, or about the program and the project in general, we'll be taking questions now. And I see we have one already from Vitaly, if you want to get us started.
Yeah, I had general question that is probably related to this flu challenge. And the question is, how do people learn about these things? How did people who participate learn about it? So I can say for myself, the way I learned about it was accident, because I just saw your preprint on the second challenge, and it just came out. I think it came out MedArchive, perhaps, or one of the archives, or BioArchive. And I read it, and it was like, oh, there's a third one. And it was really like a month left, I think, roughly, maybe one and a half or so. So very little time left for us. So we kind of didn't do a good job. So my point is, how did people learn about this? And how could you make that better advertised, I think, to the community. So people know about it, not within a month when they have to submit the challenge, but like 6 months before they submit the challenge. So yeah, that's my first question. Thank you.
So I mean, we did go through an extensive outreach approach, but clearly we missed you, which is not good. And that was partially based on reviewing previous papers published in the field, and we emailed the authors, and it was also trying outreach on Twitter/X, whatever kind of things. We tried to directly email people. We had a number of mailing lists that we went through. We hoped that the first paper would be serving as an announcement that is more read, but publication of that took for freaking ever. So we can't rely on that. Otherwise, paper publication, I think, would be the most obvious. I am curious, I mean, what you think, what do you have suggestions of what other things?
Well, my question was to the people who are on this call. We have 30 people, so 25. How did you find out? That's what you just said is what you did. Now, the question is what worked? What do people say that are on this call? Can anybody say how you found out? Thanks.
I mean, I can share very quickly. It was one postdoc in our lab sharing it in Slack, but I have no clue. I mean, I can actually ask him, but he was sharing it in some channel in Slack, and I was like, oh, yeah, that looks interesting.
That's not good. Yeah, I need original source. through Google. How did the Google? What did you Google?
So I think I participated in the second challenge when I was...
Yeah, okay. That's fine. Yeah, okay. Next. I think that's what you need to have. So, Jerns, I think you need to do a survey of these people. How did you find out? And then you will identify, you know, did you advertise, you know, what are the ways? So, none of the people I know that do computational immunology knew about it. Let me put it this way. I asked some people, like, are you doing any of this? None of them did. So I don't know who you reached. You didn't reach the people who do math modeling immunology.
I mean, Mari, I believe we are doing the follow-up. Obviously, the problem with the follow-up is then we're talking to the people who were reached. Mm-hmm. It's actually much more interesting to find the people who we did not reach, which is hard by definition. And any suggestions are welcome. And I'm obviously, we're also kind of hoping over time it builds and people know about it. So hopefully like this group, and at this point we have, I don't know how many people we contacted. I mean, we have records of contacting, I think was it 10,000 researchers in the field. So it's not a minor effort. But clearly we are still missing some. And unfortunately, these are like self-reinforcing biases that I think certain areas we are going to cover really well and others not at all.
So the paper that's the PLOS computational biology one that was just on the previous slide, that's still open for some minor revisions. Could you advertise the flu thing more prominently somewhere that people would see it?
I suspect that's in proofing stage or beyond.
Yeah, so, it's in the production state, I think.
So in the current paper that we're currently writing, I think that's where we have to really push that.
But again, you mentioned how long it will take for that to potentially come out.
No, it's going to be published immediately, of course.
Oh, yeah. And then are Google Ads still a thing? Like, is that still a relevant?
Just Google has gotten useless at this point. Yeah. But that's an idea. And then obviously the other thing is we should just get the preprint out of the result of this and that we have under control when it comes out. And I think most people at this point do read preprints, so, yeah.
And then did the original question asker have a suggestion?
I mean, I can have a lot of suggestions. I would, one possibility is just to look for keywords, say, on the NIH who is funded on to doing It doesn't have to be machine learning, but you know, immunology, mathematics, modeling, you will get the list of people who are involved with doing math. And yeah, I mean, some of them are doing more traditional model, right? Differential equation based, but it still could be an interesting challenge for them. Yeah. There's a huge group of people who are not in machine learning area. They're in the mathematical modeling area. But I think the data are interesting. That's why I got involved, even though I don't really do too much machine learning. So I think it's a subject matter. So looking for people who are in different pockets. SMB, Society for Mathematical Biology, would be a fantastic platform to advertise. So there's an annual meeting of Society of Math Bio. And if you advertise there somehow, I'm almost certain there will be lots of people who are interested in looking at the data and modeling. Yeah. Maybe other societies that are, again, involved with computational elements, just in general, computational biology. Have to be. Immunology.
I guess there's the International Society for Computational Biology. There's like the meeting is like the annual meeting is coming up quite soon in Liverpool. I forgot exactly the dates, but there might be also
right. And we've been, I mean, we have booths at ISMB. We have been reaching out. We've been trying to get speaking slots there. Then this is the other problem. This is not always so easy. No, but those are good suggestions. And maybe so we should, Mari, let's reach out again after this whole thing, also as part of the follow-up writing, and let's reevaluate the different outreach methods. So
again, my point would be is that you have a list of submitters who submitted models, and you said 50 or whatever. So ask each of the one of them, you know, when did you find out? Like that would be originally, like again, learn from the data rather than generate hypotheses. I mean, you have the data.
Oh, right, but that's also, and we are planning to do this. I mean, this is on our, this is on the planned task list.
Good. I think. Well, I just saw two answers. One through Google, so which is of course excellent. Yeah, I don't know what that means, but okay. I had a more challenging question.
I think we have to stop though.
Oh, stop. Sorry.
Can we maybe take this offline, and I would love to get more feedback by email. But Mari, I think we have a hard stop at 11:30.
Yes. Thank you so much to everyone for presenting and also joining us today. And like mentioned, we'll reach out for additional questions. But if you have any other comments or questions, if you can post on the discussion forum on the CMIPB website, that'll be fantastic. So, and we'll also be posting the recording there as well. And I sent the link in the chat. So awesome. Thank you so much and have a good rest of your day. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you all. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.